is a Channel 2 over, Sunday night after supper, the 9th of August, 1970. This is a visit, the unexpected, a surprise visit, the unexpected visit of Judy and Becky, just in from Columbia. They report on their time in Columbia. Oh, it is animated. It's a little these as they used to be. It's Channel 2 over, and beginning of the report of Becky, visit of Becky and Judy, just back from Columbia, on Sunday night after supper, the 9th of August, 1970, Channel 2 over, Sunday night, the 9th of August, 1970, the visit of Judy and Becky, report on their time in Columbia. Oh, it is animated, the little leaves as they used to be.
That thing on Calcutta. When did you get in?
What? Yes. No. Saturday morning about 1:30 we got home.
So. No, we got into Miami about what?
About 4 o'clock.
But it took us an hour getting through customs because of the animals and
parrots
people.
And dogs. Oh. You have to come see the parrots.
Oh, you got to come see those parrots. I should have brought them over to see. They are terrible.
They are. But you got them here.
Yeah, we got them too. I got to take them to the vet tomorrow.
Well,
hi, guys.
Well, bless my bones.
How you doing?
I'm doing.
Look over here.
Oh, God, good to see you.
Look at here. They brought us some goodies. I thought God would really appreciate that.
The Brandon iron.
Oh, my.
It is.
This is it. They either use this for filing or for notching this on cattle. How many cattle they had notched or something. I didn't find one, you know, any more like that. They notched it for some reason.
But gee
whiz. Isn't
that just fascinating? Look at that.
Oh,
you could use that.
Sure.
Sure, if you want.
It would be perfectly serviceable.
Even looks like you could almost make an M out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's got on it? A VA. Veterans Hospital or something.
Veterans Administration.
And look, little goodies for Christmas. Isn't that cute?
I thought these little shoes.
They're so tiny. Uh-huh. I wish. And you just got here.
Yeah.
Worn
out. You've been sleeping for days.
Oh, gosh.
It's something.
And you just brought everything. Well, you here. You left all the time.
Yeah, actually, unless we go back. We don't know what we're going to be doing. Gerald left this morning to go to the meetings in Columbia, Missouri.
Oh.
So I guess we could find out something. There's a possibility in Brazil that we may take. But I don't much want to go back over again. I'm tired of this.
Yeah, you would need a little breather.
No, I think I need a breather in the States for a while.
I think you need a little while in the States. Yeah. Oh, but listen, I just, everyone, when I looked at those pictures that you had taken with your mother brought me, and you all look so healthy and good. And I just wanted to get on a plane and come right.
Oh,
here.
Yeah.
Well, I may go back to teach down there.
I'd never see that next year if I can get a contract.
Is it a woodpecker?
Yeah.
But if I do, y'all, you can come down and stay with me.
He's a young one.
Like
I'd love to. Oh, Fefe, I just loved it. I was the mountains and everything, and it's so exciting down there. It's really nice. And
What's that?
Down in Bogota, I just loved it. The altitude, I didn't
Didn't have her headaches down there.
I didn't have one headache down. I had
one headache. I gave her that one.
Yeah. We were trying to get out of the house, and the maid and her kid were cutting up, and I just couldn't take it. It was too much.
I tried to fire, and Joe wouldn't let me fire, and we were fuming and arguing. Very interesting.
You wanted to fire and Gerald wouldn't let you?
No, Gerald, I've been wanting to fire for 6 months because I just get so out of it. When you don't want to be in your own home, something's wrong.
You didn't want to go back because she was there. She came up to Becky one day and she said, Becky, I have to, in Spanish, of course, she said, I have to get my hair cut today. And Becky said, well, Anna, can't you wait till tomorrow? Tomorrow's, you know,
there's
your day
so
off.
There's so much things
and
to do.
This is when we're getting ready to move and everything, and we were having a horrible time with this all this stuff Becky had. And she said, I've just got, me and my child have to get our hair cut today. We have to go down and get our hair cut. And Becky said, well, why on earth today? She said, well, today is the day that Jesus Christ got his hair cut. And if one is going to have their hair cut, this is the day you have it cut. Because it grows so much better and you have healthy hair and it really gives you a lot of soul.
She took that, child who had the prettiest, lush hair down her back, or this darling, beautiful little girl, and wiped it off within a half an inch of her skull.
Oh,
so it would grow faster.
Oh, he laughed over that for days.
She used to come out and serve dinner and just cry and cry because the jello was just running all over the plate.
Oh, no.
And Becky told her time and time again, Anna, don't put the jello in the freezer. And she said, no, it makes it gel faster. And you couldn't tell her that after you take it out of the freezer, the ice will make it melt. You know, it'll just run. And she just cried and cried.
And what did you say, Becky, when you didn't want to go to your own home?
Something's wrong. I was, the night we moved, I told her she asked for a recommendation because she'd be working for an American who didn't know any Spanish at all. And I said, I know what it was like, and I'm not going to go put a woman through that, so I wouldn't give her a recommendation because she'd just been giving me prom after prom. And her child lived in with us, which is all right, but still, the kid was into all my stuff and breaking things a lot of times. And so I told her I would not give her one. And so Gerald gave her one.
Becky was serious.
I was serious. So I didn't want to see her again because of all kinds of problems you'd have with her. So I sat on the park.
For 2 hours waiting.
Freezing cold, waiting on her to leave up in that pocket.
Oh.
Now, what was her name?
Her name was Anna. And her child's name was Claudia. And I have never.
And the child is not supposed to live in.
Well, no, really not. I mean, most people will not hire a child that lives in. I put up with it, especially if they are their own. But I felt sorry for the poor woman. Really, they have a level of education. She had probably second or third grade level education.
That's why she offered
and
the
she
job.
I mean, the thing is, you just couldn't reason with her. So the type of reasoning that I could reason with myself or with anyone else that I associate, even Colombians I associate with, you couldn't reason with her because you just didn't understand it. She made mayonnaise one day, homemade mayonnaise, and came in, and oil down there is expensive. Oil and eggs, just terribly expensive. She had this stuff that was pink with black polka dots in it. It just these specks. I said, what have you done? She said, oh, I'm so proud I made this mayonnaise. I said, well, that looks lovely. But something went wrong because it should be white and fluffy. And she said, well, we'll look and see. So I looked up and she didn't know how to divide things in halves. And she said, well, three and a half cups is very near 3 cups. And so she just put in 3 cups of this because she didn't know what the half was. I got so tickled. That was really funny, though. That was just pathetic.
It was.
And I tried to show her, and no matter what I did to show her, you know, a half a cup, I'd say, all right, now, what's about a half on this cup? She'd still give me a whole cup.
After a while, it gets.
Yeah, after a while, I just quit.
I used to iron all half the night long. She complained. She said, oh, Mrs. Fisher, I cannot. I have to stay up
all
night
long
ironing. And Becky said, well, look, she said, for 4 hours in the afternoon, you don't have
anything.
From
12 to 4, she didn't do anything on her schedule.
At all. Absolutely nothing. She'd take the, at 12 o'clock, she'd take the meat out of the freezer to defrost for supper, and then she had nothing to do until 4
o'clock
when she
started dinner.
And Becky said, well, why don't you iron during that 4 hour period when you rest or you just take time
off of it because you don't need 4 hours to iron every day.
Yeah. She said, well, she said, one just does not take their hands and put them from cold to hot. She said, I cannot take the meat out of the freezer and then go iron. I have to wait at least a half a day before I can iron.
And we asked if she was ironing which side she was putting her hand on the iron. I figured she was.
No.
You think you're not going to ever miss it when you have to go and cook your own dinner?
Everyone says, you know, they say, oh, this and that. I'm in cultural shock. They write these things. Gerald went in cultural shock. Gerald was in terrible condition yesterday. He's so run down anyway. And the altitude, change in altitude made him sick. But I'm always so glad to come home. I feel great. The only time I get sick is when I go back there. I don't like the mountains. The mountains are just too high for me, really.
Oh, really?
Doctors up there, they ran barium tests on me in the winter, in December. And they said that the only thing, I was having a terrible lot of gas and stomach problems, and they said that they really thought that it was altitude.
Uh-huh.
Because anytime I'd go down the mountain there to this little place called Hirado, this little pueblo, I wouldn't have any trouble. And I could feel the change, and I feel much better, you know, around sea level than I do that high, because it's nearly 9,000 feet.
Yeah, well, that could make a difference, yeah.
It's high.
That could make a difference.
Yeah,
that's high. And to me, it's
high. Oh, I loved it.
Mm-hmm. And she does real well. Gerald did all right up there, fine, but when he came back, well, he's so busy and so worried about this job business and getting his dissertation through that he's a wreck. He's lost weight. You know, he's thin.
I know it.
He's lost more weight. He didn't stop and settle down. He's not going to be with us much longer.
Well,
Becky, you certainly don't look convalescent.
No, I'm not. Not really.
You really look.
Every picture that's ever come back from down there has looked so rugged.
Yeah.
I really have.
Mm-hmm.
So it's.
We've got some we hide, though.
I imagine.
When I went down with Joe, we were doing a study in this really primitive condition. And these people, the best people in the world, were down there. They're just as kind, and they would give you things that they wouldn't, you know, they're chickens. They would insist on fixing you chicken. And they wouldn't eat that chicken. 1 month out of a year would they ever have a chicken because they're so poor.
High.
And they're just as kind as they could be. And we went down there, and they feed you this rice and this yucca. Fried yucca, rice, plátano, which is a big banana-like thing, which is really rather good if it's fixed correctly. And which is three starches and sometimes a corn-like tortilla, maybe a little piece of meat. And of course, you couldn't eat all that because it's so starchy, you know. You just can't. I can't anyway. And my stomach got so bloated down there, and they took a picture of me, and I. That's gosh, hide the picture in the back of the slide. All right. Oh no.
That would be something.
You know what? But it's interesting, it really is. And the kindest people really are the poorest.
That's right. Yeah.
I really think the poorest people down there are the most sympathetic and the kindest. I mean, really, they're not only kind in their attitude toward you, but they're interested in what's going on elsewhere. And how your attitude is about. They were very interested. Even in the jungle, they wanted to know how I felt about Negroes. You know, because they knew I was from the States.
Is that right?
They were really fascinated. Because they had one family had a girl that was really dark. And she was showing me around town and telling me things. And funerals were coming into town. It was really, really a sad thing because the town had just mud streets. And the only access to civilization was a 15-minute plane trip out by a puddle jumper that landed in the soccer field. Oh.
They went out one night to walk turnips, and right next door to us, we noticed this unusual amount of cars. And what had happened was the man right in the very next house, and the houses, you know, were just right together. They aren't separated.
They're gone.
Yeah. Died, and his coffin was up there in the window with the two candles in front of it, and I was petrified. I made Nancy sleep with
she
me
was
that night.
Really,
I was scared
she
to
was
death.
Terrified.
But we got, so we went out and walked turnip to see what was going on, and then we came back in. And about 7 o'clock, I call him the warmonger. He's the man on the other side of us who has a family. Little boys went to the school where we taught at. And they were having a party. He was an American. And he's got an arsenal in his house.
Oh,
he's more machine guns.
It
was very aggressive. And they had a party. And they knew there was this funeral on the other side of us. And they had music that was so loud you could hear it 3 blocks away. And they had this party until 3 o'clock in the morning.
And we're in the middle of it.
The middle of it. A funeral on one side and a fiesta on the other.
We're having a wake over there is what they were doing.
It was. And everybody was in and out all night long. Gosh. I think I was going to make it.
She was terrified. She was.
I was just petrified.
Well, now, let me see. I didn't follow all that.
Yes.
The people next door, right next door, the man had died.
Yeah.
And they had a funeral. And when they have funerals down
what
there.
What is that about the coffin in the window?
They bring the body back to the home. And they have the coffin in the window. And they don't, you know, they don't embalm people.
Well, they
know
it wasn't in the window, but it's stretched out right in front. You saw it looking in the window, even with the shades, the
curtains
drawn. You saw this coffin up there, and you saw banks of flowers around, and these two
candles
sticking up. And there are people sitting there in chairs around it. And the houses, guy, are hooked right on together. I mean, the walls, they're not separated at all. The gardens are in the back, and they're private things, no bigger than this room. Little gardens with walls all up 8-9 feet high. And our house, the house in the corner had a funeral. Then there was our house. Then there was a warmonger's house. And he was having a party. You wouldn't beat it.
And
you could hear the music. We walked out because we wanted to see what was happening.
With the wake.
with the wake.
11 o'clock.
And the wake was really going on there. It must have been, the streets were blocked with cars.
50 people in there.
And it's a fairly nice neighborhood, especially for Colombian people to live in, because they have to pay their houses. And the warmonger and us, we get ours with our housing allowance with the government. And I couldn't believe it. They kept that music up all until 3 a.m.
3 o'clock in the morning.
And the next morning, we asked the little boy, did y'all know there was a funeral on the corner here? Why, yes, we knew it a long time ago.
Then the man died. Oh, it was something.
We could figure the police were going to come.
Yeah.
They really did.
Oh, that was something.
It was
when they had all the elections down there and they had all the problems, Becky asked...
What's the warmonger?
He's a
military. He's a sergeant in the Army, and he's in a good situation because of the fact that, well, he's down there, and the government keeps him down there. He's on a good... He has a housing allowance, which puts him in a good upper income bracket as far as Columbia is concerned. And it's really an unrealistic situation. Like when we were down there, you would just people, Colombians coming into our home would think we were quite wealthy because the government, the Nebraska Commission paid for our housing. And so this is a great, takes care of a great deal. And the sergeant, who's just a sergeant, if he were in the States, he would, where a sergeant earns in the States, he would have been just down the bottom level here. But he was down there, and they paid for his housing and so forth.
He drove
and
a big gold,
big gold
Bonneville
car.
You know, more the dark glasses and the gold stuff hanging off.
And
of
he was that. He was really honest. That's all he was a sergeant, because several times.
Why do they call him a warmonger?
Judy calls him that because he's aggressive.
He's very aggressive.
His kids, we asked. This is a good joke. His kids. I had his little boy in school. And when we were having so much trouble with the politics down there, it looked like we were going to have to clear out because they were going to sack the northern part of the city one night, and the president apparently got a hold of this, President Yeris, got a hold of information and stopped him and imposed a curfew and a state of siege on the country.
There's another name for it. What's
it? Toque de queda.
Yeah.
And anyway, the little boy, I told him, I said, well, John, are you ready to go? And he said, no, I said, how you doing? And he said, fine, fine. And I said, well, are you all ready? You know, because I meant we're ready, we got to leave the country because it looks like we've got to clear out. He said, are you ready? He said, yes, we're ready. I said, got your bags packed? He said, bags packed? He said, no. He said, we got our submachine guns ready.
So my daddy went out and bought 22 extra rounds for it. And
I couldn't believe what they had
and everything. They had everything but a tank and the A-bomb in their house. I've never seen anything like
that. You wouldn't believe it. And you would think that an American would have sense enough to stay out of another country's political problems there. Good gosh, Moses. And the maid that night, we had gone, a friend of myself, and I went into the city to see what was happening. And there were about 10,000 people rioting up there, and we got involved in the middle of it. And we were coming out, and our bus barely made it through this mob that was coming down the street. We stopped for a red light, and on the main one of the main arteries, stopped, and we looked down, and here comes this mob of screaming people down the street. So the bus gunned it through the red light, and we missed the people, just got through the people. Then coming up this way, the people were going this way. Coming up this way, we had to stop because all these tanks were coming into town to surround this group of people and keep them under control. So the tanks are coming this way, the people are going that way.
And they were in the middle of
it. We were in the middle of it, but it was really quite bad. It got really rather frightening down there. And we were afraid that we were going to have to clear out. It looked like.
That was in the spring, wasn't it?
Yeah.
What was the occasion?
It was the presidential elections, and what happened is that, well, the U.S. was all tangled up down there, too, which really infuriated me to death. I mean, I don't think they should have been that emotionally involved in someone else's affairs, but they were. There were two candidates, were Rojas, which is definitely communist, and then there was a Pastrana, which was... he was more democratic. There are two fronts, and they agreed to switch fronts, and these two men were running under the same party title because since the last revolution, they've agreed to work out something so that they're two parties, two major parties. And one four-year term this party takes, and the other four-year term this party takes it. And the two candidates within this other party, one was a communist and one was a liberal-type conservative. I don't know exactly how you phrase him, but this President Yeris, who is a quite dynamic individual and has held the country right intact, was backing Pastrana. Well, of course, he backed Pastrana because he was more democratic. Rojas was a communist, and
he had been in there,
and had concentration camps, and he was the cause of the last revolution. Well, this Rojas had been campaigning for the last 12 years, and he'd gone out into the campo, the real country-like areas, and had paid people to vote for him, and he had really... The country wasn't much worried about Rojas, and still they started having elections because they said, oh, he won't get it. I mean, it's impossible that anyone would vote for him because he's so old and senile, and his daughter is running it.
He had a pacemaker in his heart to keep it going.
Yeah, his daughter is running the thing, and the country will remember, the people of the country will remember what happened last time he was in. So, but the votes started coming in that night, and I was really concerned because it sounded like he was running pretty close. So that night, it got so that Pastrana was losing and Rojas was beginning to pour away on ahead of him. And then they cut the news media off completely. They called off the radio, the television station went off the air. And then the next day the paper said that Pastrana, the other man, had won. Which was funny, you know. It was obvious that Rojas got it.
All the Colombian people said that Rojas really won, even though they had voted for Pastrana. And
yeah,
and
even the ones that voted for Pastrana were very upset because they said, well, this wasn't right. The elections definitely were fixed. But they're fixed anyway. I mean, you know, no matter what you say, they're fixed.
And the United States got in it?
Well, the U.S. had, they came down and they said there was a loan that Colombia wanted, a very big loan, and the U.S. was pulling it through for them. And so the U.S. said they wouldn't, shortly after the elections, they said, well, we'll be glad to give you your loan, but we wait until about August 10th or so, until we see what type of situation your country's in. Okay. In other words, if this Pastrana doesn't go in, because Rojas swore he won, and he said, I will take the country by force if I have to.
And he was going to. When he left there were tanks on the street.
Yeah, they had the military. Yeah. Everyone was very... Yeah. No one was out. It was quiet and all.
Pull up a chair.
Nick Eschbach, Becky Feaster.
How do you do?
Judy Lee.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
They're just in from Bogota.
Ooh.
Becky's been living down there for years and years, and Judy's been there all
too.
Summer. Well, so you.
Well, what happened? How'd the United States fare?
Well, the U.S. is faring okay because Pastrana's being put in down there.
Right after
that happened, some top U.S. officials went in to confer with Yaris about the problem of Rojas taking over. But I don't know, you know, the thing's fixed anyway. The election's always fixed. The thing is, they didn't fix it quite enough on Pastrana's side. So some of the voting ISL friends tell me that went out into the voting areas and Peace Corps and people, and they said that several people were cut up quite badly because there'd be certain districts that you'd go in to vote for Rojas, and if you came in and tried to vote for Pastrana, they would kill you.
They'd just say, who are you voting for?
Who are you voting for?
And if you said Pastrana, they'd just cut your throat right there on the street.
And it was really... And in our neighborhood, which is a quiet neighborhood, they were screaming and chanting at 6 a.m. they started, because they were for Pastrana. I needed to go in there and vote for anyone else. So the whole thing...
You can go in the Pastrana area and vote for Rojas.
Gee whiz.
It's interesting.
Well, now, what was the mob doing?
Well, the mob was a mad group of, actually, their Rojistas, which came in. They were, the Rojistas were the poor level wanted Rojas in, because he promised them all these things. He was going to make the dollar and the peso equal. And since we've been in there, it's gone up from 16, the exchange rate of about 15, to nearly 20, to 19, I think, when we left. So the dollar is becoming more valuable, and he keeps saying, and the peso is devaluing, he keeps saying, no, he's going to make them equal. Make a one-to-one exchange, which is impossible, and he says all these things he can't possibly do. And the poor people, being ignorant, they listen to him. And so...
Your maid.
Yeah. Well, now, she wanted Pastrana. She said, oh, no, because she didn't want to go back into the revolution. She said, because if Rojas had, from what we understand, if Rojas had gotten in, he would have had to liberate the poor people. And let the poor people do what they wanted, or they would have killed him. And so then the poor would have just come in and taken what they wanted of the rich.
They would have over in Chico and then gone into our area, La Castellana, and just gone through the entire area and just killed people and taken what they wanted.
What
it would have literally amounted
to. What happened the night that we had, Gerald was to have a job, it was the funniest thing. This man was coming in to interview Gerald, this man named Mr. Feaster. to interview him for
a
job in Costa Rica, which it was frozen actually. I mean, it froze right after we applied for it. What was it? He came in that night and he was telling us he had been in revolutions and so forth, and there's no problem. We didn't need to worry. There wasn't any problem. I said, well, I'm sorry, sir, but I went downtown today and there is problems. I said, there are just mobs all over. Like I said, broken windows, and each night they'd work their way farther toward the north of the city. And usually when they have revolutions, they just tear up their own section, you know. But now they had gotten wise. Then they were going to storm the northern part of the city where all the rich lived, which was a smart idea, really. They were getting at the source of their problem. So I told him, no, he was mistaken. I really thought that we were going to have problems. And he said, no. And the president was to speak that night. So we turned on the television. He wanted to hear it. And it was 8 o'clock, and the president said, all right, I'm putting the country in a state of siege. You have a curfew. I want you in your houses in 1 hour. 1 hour, you'll be off the streets, or else you can be shot. And so he got his stuff. He gobbled a few bites and ran out of there so fast.
And he said, turn on the lights in the car.
So they'll see your gringos, and they won't kill you. But it was the craziest thing, because, I mean, really, they were, when Yeris, he was an extremely marvelous president, excellent. When he got wind of what was happening, they had found dynamite in the northern parts of the city where they were going to just blast the whole rich area, all the rich areas. And they were bringing in these campesinos out of the country from all these poor areas on trucks loaded with machetes and guns and stuff to just take over.
And Becky told her maid, she listened to the television, she said, Anna, quick, fill up the bucket, we need water, And Anna went charging outside into the garage and got this great big green hose and was running up the stairs. Becky says, what in the hell are you doing? What are you taking the hose upstairs for? She says, I'll squirt them when they come through the door.
She was going to squirt the mob, says it came by out the window. I said, good gosh.
That is crazy as she could be.
But we didn't know if lights and power, what was going to be cut off. So we got all our things filled with water, you know, to sort of halfway live in case anything came up.
I thought you went down there to live a quiet life.
Well, I did, and it turned out to be a juror was complaining about the rat race in the States about that time. And I said, are you joking me?
You can't live a quiet life down there. It's impossible. It's
well, a lot of it was his dissertation. We were really having to work, and
it wasn't all Bogota.
Mm-mm. No, it wasn't all Bogota.
A lot of it was, though.
Well, what did you we got good reports from you about Bogota, Colombia. And what was it you were pleased with?
We were really quite pleased with the way one lives down there. The Colombians really generally like Americans. They get along real well with them. I don't know exactly. The traffic, I didn't care too much about the traffic, but you can't expect that in a city that size that you have traffic problems. It's interesting because it's different. And the type of culture, you know, that you're exposed to and all, and the language and stuff, I enjoyed it very much, really.
Well, you went with Gerald and all these. Every time I heard about you, you were out on the Amazon or some wild outing with him.
That is fun. The people that are back in these areas where you don't normally get to are interesting. They really are. They're good people. They want, you know, they're not so much their education, because they don't have any education, but it's just they deal with you in the way they talk and are interested and so forth.
They want to learn, whereas Anna had no desire to learn at all.
Well, she did. She had a desire to learn. The trouble is in the way of handling them, Faye. Because you go in there, and when I first got her, I had her 2 years. When I first got her, she was a marvelous person. She learned very easily. You could teach her things. But after a year, she just sort of, I wasn't there to, you know, see what was going on. And her child was playing with the percolator and submerging this and breaking that. And these things would turn up, and rather than me investigate them, I just sort of, you know, I just hate to get down to irritate, you know, bickering with people over things like that. I just can't stand it. But I guess I should have done it, because it just, you know,
it got worse.
The Colombians don't allow them to do this. They don't allow them to do that. They put, you know, they say, you do this, you do that, and so forth. And I feel like I could say, you're running my home. You come in. I will show you what I want done, and within a certain level, you run it the way I want to. I shouldn't have to tell her you put 2 teaspoons here every time you do it, you know, whereas a Colombian will. I feel like they ought to have enough sense to know after you tell them a couple of times.
But they
do, but yet they will do something to take advantage of you. The least little thing she got mad at, She couldn't, she was very immature, even though she was 26, I think, 27. She didn't know how to handle her emotions, and if she got frustrated on something, and like the Jell-O business, she wouldn't take your advice. I'd say, the Jell-O is not fixing because you're freezing it. Put it in the refrigerator. No, you're wrong. I'd say, all right, do it your way, but don't cry with me about the Jell-O. And I should have said, demanded that you put it in the refrigerator, you see? But I mean, with me teaching and all, I said, I don't want to have to check up every time and see where the Jell-O goes. I swear, I got to worry about the Jell-O. I'm not sure, just stop.
Well, did the teaching take a right smart time?
Yeah. You mean to teach Anna?
Just teaching in school.
Oh, teaching in school. Yeah, I'd go at 7:30 and not come back until probably 3:30 or 4.
Oh, full-time job.
Yeah, it's a full-time job. Now, this summer wasn't. This summer I just taught an hour and a half. But, I mean, it's a full-time situation which you're not home all day. And there...
Gee whiz, that's a different What all did you do?
With teaching?
Mm.
I taught third grade. I taught fourth the year before and then third this year. And it's really interesting because you're teaching bilingual children. Actually, they're not totally bilingual. They're bilingual as far as a child goes, but they're not totally bilingual.
But you could handle the language real well.
You could handle, after you got used to it, yeah. My language, my Spanish is terrible, but I can communicate to get across what I mean, and they understand me.
Well, I didn't have any problems, and I didn't speak any Spanish, and they understood me.
But you never have problems. You don't have to put up with Anna.
That's right. Well, yes, I did. She sabotaged my sweater.
She got mad at her. She was sure. You know, they do just do little things. If you'd like, you'd feel like, well, it's your home. I want to. In my home, I want things done a certain way, and I expect if I'm nice to you, you'll be nice to me. You see, and as long as I don't come down here and demand things and say, look, I want this done, I want this done. Why should she be mad at me? Well, she'd get mad at a certain little thing, like she got mad at herself, and then she'd take it on us. Like we took stockings down there, and she kept bringing them back with these enormous holes in them. And I said, well, how did that happen? I don't know, you ripped them. And I know they weren't ripped, you know, when you take them down there. And just little needly things that sort of,
Having somebody live in 24 hours is the thing. You never are free of
it.
This is it. And I told Dad, I wrote and told Daddy, and Dad said, oh, you shouldn't do it because Mom and Dad were down there a week. And Anna would wait on them hand and foot. She knew
they
were my parents. And Mom, all she'd go down and say, dos cafes, and she'd run up there with these coffees every morning at 6 o'clock, you know. And I wouldn't get up till 7:38, and she just thought Anna was the greatest thing you've ever seen. She waited on your hand and foot. And I said, Mom, you don't understand. So one day, I had enough of it. I wrote home and I told Dad I was just having a lot of problems, and that I couldn't get the maid to understand the child should not go in any of the bedrooms and play with my stuff. That I don't like that. And she had her own room, and she could stay down there. And so Dad wrote back, oh, this and that. Oh, I should be grateful for this. So I wrote back and I said, well, I think it's a good thing that I bring the maid back with me. I'll bring the maid back and the child and let them live with you, because many Americans bring their maids back and they keep them in their homes and they pay them a decent salary, but they have a living maid all the time. I said, that will be marvelous. I'll just bring her back and I'll pay for her to come back in here. You just pay her salary. I'll pay for her to come back in here and I'll get her papers and say, well, I said, but Dad, when you find jam on your piano and your violin strings broken and the little things in your little treasure box missing, don't say anything. And he didn't write another word about her. Not another word. I shut him up good. I laughed so hard about that thing because I could just see him now starting to play his piano and having some type of kid that had been jamming fingers on.
Picking his violin up and finding jam fingers.
Oh, no. But they were only curious, you know, and interested, which is a normal thing. But, you know, you have to forgive them for that because they haven't seen these things.
Uh-huh.
They don't know what they're like, and they're interested in them. But they haven't had enough exposure to normal things that we've been exposed to know how to appreciate them and take care of them. They just don't know, like the blender. They took the blender and they were playing with the blender. I said, you don't pull the blender up and down when the thing is on. And they stripped the gears of the thing so the thing would spin around.
She was playing with it. She thought it was a toy or something.
Oh, it's just fun.
Well, she just had 3 or 4 hours a day.
Yeah, it wouldn't be bad.
Here we were just feeling so happy because Becky had a live-in maid.
Oh, your mom kept writing about this live-in maid. They're good, really. They're good, and you can get some good ones. And the problem with me is I should have changed. But Gerald just felt so bad for her. He said, that's awful. She can't get another job, this and that. And I said, I know, Gerald, but you got to think we got to live here, too. And he said, well, you've only got 6 more months to go. All right. 5 more months. 4 more. The last day, I said, out. And Gerald said, you've got 1 more day. Oh, no.
Brought us a Brandon iron. How old is it, Judy?
It's between 50 to 80 years old. Isn't it from college?
Oh, it's not a new one.
No, no. It's a...
Oh, Brandon iron.
I don't know where it's from that area.
Probably Collie, I'd say.
Oh, gee whiz. You'll have to write a little sketch of it, so I'll know what to say about it.
This is a Brandon iron.
You know, everybody thought I was so crazy. I found this bird whistle in the Galleria de Bogota, and it's about this big guy, but it was sitting in this lighted little case on a piece of red velvet, and it was gorgeous, and it's perfectly formed, everything, and the most beautiful sound to it, and I bought it. And the thing's 500 years old from the Tamako culture, and I have the little papers on it and everything. And Dave said, you brought back a 500-year-old bird whistle. Exactly. With that.
Judy,
but it's beautiful.
What we heard about you is you made all this money and had to spend it down there.
I spent every cent of it.
You couldn't bring any back.
Oh, she didn't
even
try.
I didn't try. I didn't want to.
Oh, you could have.
Yeah, but I didn't.
She could have. We could have cashed it in more, but she didn't.
I was having so much fun.
I couldn't believe it.
Well, I like to get the truth of the matter.
Yeah, that's the truth. I went nuts. I had so much fun and just, you know, go out and just see little different odds and ends you like and just
think, I've got to spend this money anyway, so I'm
I've just
got
to do it. That's right.
She was so worried when she came down there about spending that money. She said, I'll never get spent. I said, Judy, just calm down. You wait. And then she said, I'm not going to have enough.
We were going to go down to fly down to Cali, where these things are from, and go out into this field. This friend of Gerald's has an uncle who lives down in Cali, and what he does is he digs into Indian graves and finds Indian gold and pots and these things and mummies. And we were going to go down there and dig with him, but we never got a chance to. I was really excited about that.
Oh, yeah.
That would be
interesting. They have them all over the place, and the government's not too picky about it. I mean, they're starting to now. We brought back quite a few old pots in our shipment.
Santa Marta beads.
Yeah. And some Santa Marta beads.
You're not supposed to do that.
No.
But we did. They sell them down there. And I wore mine back, wore it out of Aduana, past customs, onto the plane, the ones I gave Daddy, and into the Miami airport and on off. No one said anything.
Well, she brought another pair back that she had hidden that has a hunk of Indian gold in it.
Oh, they're beautiful.
Piece.
I got them for Gerald for his birthday, and they're lovely.
I have to tell you what Becky did about the dog.
What did she do?
She called up Braniff International and she said, look, I have a dog I want to ship back to the United States and I want to find out how much it's going to cost to ship him. And they said, well, it's $1 a pound overweight. And she blew up. She said, well, the dog's huge. She said, including his crate and himself, it'll be $120 to ship him back. She said, that's impossible. And the man said, well, I'm sorry, that's what it is. And she said, well, in that case, she said, what I'll just do is buy him a first class ticket for $113 and he can ride with me up in the cabin and he can have his filet mignon and drinks before dinner and carry 66 pounds of luggage. And the man said, now wait a minute, lady, wait a minute, you can't do that. And Becky said, are you discriminating?
I got so mad at those people, they irritate me to death.
And so they changed it. They said, wait just a minute, we'll put you into cargo, you can talk to cargo. But she told him, she said, well, I'll just buy him a first class ticket.
Really, it would have been just as cheap. And so, I mean, I saw no reason why not.
Yeah.
He just take his seat.
Because if he could do, I don't see how in the world they could charge you that fantastic rate. If I could pay more for a dog than I would a human being, plus a human being can take 66 pounds of luggage.
And
they really panicked. And then I just told him, I said, are you discriminating? No, lady, wait a minute. So they hooked me up to cargo, and they charged me 92 cents a kilo, which is 2.2 pounds.
So how much did it cost?
So it cost me about $44 just for the birds and the dog to get back in here.
Brought how many parrots?
Two.
Two
and
parrots?
Yes, you got to come see them. I should have brought them over there. Darling. Oh, they're darling.
Well, see, your little whatchamadoodle died.
You might
Guagua.
Guagua. He drowned.
He drowned.
Drowned in the bathtub.
And Nell died.
Nell died, yeah.
Oh, they would have had another dog.
Well,
and
all that mortality. Guagua.
It was awful. Nell, well, we knew Nell was going, but, I mean, it was just terrible because she, really, the vet there gave her 3 weeks to live. He said she won't live over a month after they operated, that she couldn't possibly. And so then after that, she lived 9 months. But she got worse and worse, and she really didn't get... She wasn't suffering, because if she was suffering, I would have put her to sleep. But she wasn't suffering. She was just, you know, she was just slowing down.
Uh-huh.
And so then she died, and then exactly, was it 2 weeks to the day, the very day, that Guagua climbed in the stone washing vat and drowned. It was horrible. They called me at school to tell me this, and the whole school was up in arms because they thought the other dog had died, and they knew how much the first one had meant. And then we found out that the Guagua had drowned, and then the maid wanted to eat him. And well I told her it's expensive meat, and I said, well, by doing they're poor, you know, if they enjoy the meat, the thing's dead, what can I do about it? Let them eat him. So I let them eat him. Then they had a fight over because they said they could have sold it for $3 a pound to the Tecondama. Oh, it never, I give them. Oh,
it was a fat Guagua.
It was a very fat Guagua. He ate the most
very well.
Interesting thing.
What did he eat?
Clothes off the line.
He ate
was an animal.
He ate a plastic chair, a lawn chair.
A plastic chair. He was no bigger than this. He was like a guinea pig, but about 50 times the size of a guinea pig. 40 or 50 times, wouldn't you say? He's about this big. About this time, he must have weighed about 20 pounds.
Like a moving
and he
lawnmower.
Went, bah, bah. This is the type of sound he made. And he was like, had two, these rodent-like teeth. And he was, I think he could have been a pretty smart animal. I was trying to leash break him, but he never would leash break. And I was gonna bring him back in, but then they someone told me that they were articles came in the paper that the animals were going extinct, that the guaguas, because so many people were eating them, they were good meat, they were going extinct. So we had brought him back on an airplane out of the jungle. So I told Gerald when he went back down, then he was to take him back down and let him go in the jungle. Well, he never lived, because he had lived there nearly 2 years, and then he climbed up in that one night and drowned. I don't see how the thing was this high. It was as high off the ground as the stove is, and he climbed up there. And the little thing is no more than this high off the ground. But he got around. He ate baskets. He would eat. I mean, you'd feed him well, and he loved beets. Oh, he loved to cook beets better than anything. And he would climb around, and he would eat. Oh, he ate all kinds of interesting things. He ate the chair up. Oh yeah, let me tell you. The first night we had him, we had just gotten our freezer in from the States. And thank goodness here was this new freezer I could store meat in, and I wouldn't have to go out and shop every 2 days to get all this horrible meat that was down there. So we got this freezer and got it hooked up and so forth, and we brought the guagua in, and the guagua was used to a hot climate, and the parrots were too, so we said, well, we'll keep him in the house tonight. If we put him outside in the garden, he might die because the change in climate might be too much for him besides the altitude. So we kept him in his basket, and he was asleep in this little basket. Left him down there, and about 3 o'clock in the morning, the dogs went like this into the door, and then turn up, start baying like a hound, and we let him out because we thought, my gosh, a criminal was in here. So we let him out, and they tore down the stairs, and they were on the trail of something. And then it dawned on me that guagua, something might have happened. Well, the basket had overturned, and the guagua got out of the basket and was loose in the house, and the dogs tracked him, and finally they found him under the freezer. Well, he'd gotten back way under the freezer, and we couldn't get him out. So Gerald said, well, we'll just wait till tomorrow morning, not worry with him. So that morning they got him out, and Joe went on to work, and he got this call from home, and the maid said, the freezer's off and all this meat is spoiling. What's happened? And Gerald knew I'd be furious because I told him to get the animal out from under the freezer. I didn't know what he would do back there. He gnawed through 3 cables and didn't even electrocute himself. 3 cables he went through because they were cut in half. And they called him at the mission, and they said, "There's a Gerald Feaster, your animal has eaten through three freezer cables. Report to your house immediately." He came tearing out, and the animal had gnawed through three of the freezer cables. I couldn't believe he would have done, and he didn't. Wasn't even damaged. He seems to me well electrocuted himself. Just went right through the insulation.
How did you get your freezer?
Gerald taped it back together with the freezer thing. I couldn't believe it. And he was always into things. One night, I opened the door and he came. He went up 5 flights of stairs to the bedroom and hid under the bed up there. No one knew it. Jerome was up there that time, and Jerome got up and he said, there was something under the bed. And I said, oh, forget it, Jerome, there's a bear skin like rug there, but there's nothing under the bed. Oh, yes, it. So, and he looked under this and was chattering and chewing his teeth. He got in there.
And you brought him in from the jungle.
Yeah. He's what they call them lapas, and they call them guaguas. G-U-A-G-U-A.
Guagua.
So we just called him Guagua.
Uh-huh. That is a good name, isn't it?
Good name, isn't it?
And your painter friend.
That's Judy's friend now. My gosh.
You got his baby baptized, and then he got married.
No, he didn't get married.
Judy's hoping he won't.
Judy, I'm trying to get him, but oh, Faye, have you seen him? He's so cute.
I saw the picture, and I saw the baby. It was so cute.
Oh, he's adorable. Come on, bring up that baby, please.
Yeah, I told her, I said, Judy, the man's got moral obligation. She said, forget it, forget it.
She's the godmother of a baby that doesn't
have a mother.
Can't get the mama and daddy to marry.
Oh, they're funny because, I mean, well, he's a marvelous person. And I told Judy, Judy says, what does he look like? I said, well,
He looks like a monkey.
Really, he does look sort of like a monkey. He's a very nice person, but he looks sort of like a monkey. We have this friend that we call her Cheese because she looks like a piece of cheese.
Oh, yes,
she really does.
She was really funny.
But there was a crazy thing, and she met him, and she said, I thought you said he looked like a monkey. I said, but he does look like a monkey. But she just, oh, he was a cute monkey.
He's adorable.
And
we went to that
pictures?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to try and get him an exhibition here if I can. I'm working on it.
Oh.
At least someplace. I don't know where. We went up to that baptism, Aunt Faith, and Becky said, well, it's Catholic. You've got to wear hats.
Oh, Lord.
So Becky found this black hat that you could fold up more
Mom
or less.
Mom had given her that thing that
yes.
you just crumple up.
And Nancy borrowed this little thing, you know, like little Catholic. Yeah, that from Anna. And Becky had this white hat that happened to match the dress I was wearing. It was about this big, and you couldn't do anything with it but hold it. And here we come up to this church, very definitely gringas, and we're walking up to this church, these great big huge tall American women and one tall American man, and there's a funeral at the church. And Becky said, my God, there must be some mistake. There's a funeral at this church. There's no baptism. And they had the cars out there with all the flowers on the top, the whole business, and everybody was in black. And here we come, and Nancy ripped off her hat, and Becky ripped off her, and I had to carry this huge white hat, and these Colombians were looking at me just, I was never been so embarrassed. But they had a funeral and a baptism at the same time.
They had mass
church.
Baptism is what they were doing.
Yeah, right, in the same
mass
church.
Just a group of people come with their kids and the priest baptize them. But I don't understand because, first of all, the padrinos, the godparents, were supposed to be Catholic. I didn't know what was going on. Half was in Latin and half was in Spanish. And my Spanish isn't that detailed that I could understand what the man was saying. He kept asking me things.
And the mother showed up, and she
showed up to give Dimitri the baby.
Well,
and then Dimitri gives me the baby. I said, well, I'm not supposed to be holding the baby. Well, the mother left. What do you want me to do? I said, all right. I have never, and the poor kid was scared to death. They really must take him to a horror. Because the poor kid, first of all, they dumped this freezing water on their heads. And any kid that had in that cold weather, give him pneumonia. And the kid had
just been sick
for a month. Dumped him in cold water, his head in cold water.
And then they burned him with a candle.
Then they took a hot candle, and put it for him to touch, and he had to touch it. Then they covered his head with a cloth
and put sand and stuff
this,
all over his head.
If this kid survives this, he's going to be a good Catholic. Oh, I can
believe. Well, that's right. At 9,000 feet, it'd be chilly most of the time.
Oh, yeah. And that poor kid, just for a month, he had the grief of this terrible cold and bronchial-like problem. And the kid was screaming bloody murder. And, it was really rather cruel. I don't know why he got that done. He's not that religious.
I know it. If he's not religious enough to get
married. I don't know what he's doing.
Well, how did Nancy take to all this?
Oh, Nancy enjoyed it. She really liked it. It's
well,
a shame.
You just never know who's going to take to what, do you?
I know it. we had this boy, this very, very wonderful person, Eduardo Jacone, that we were going to fix Nancy up with. Very nice boy. And Gerald, I said, well, Gerald, how old is he? And Gerald kept saying, well, he's not too old, he's not too old, he's nice. And of course, Colombian men are very short. And I'm pretty tall for an American, I guess.
No, you're not pretty tall for American. You're just tall for
Colombian, all right. And so I thought, well, if he's anything, Dimitri looks like a monkey. And they say, this guy's really out of them, you know, really nice. And I said, oh, I don't mind meeting him because Nancy had come back. Yeah. See? And I met this Eduardo Chacon, who's a very extremely nice person. But I wrote back to Mom and Dad, and I said, he's just the opposite from me. He's long on years and short on height.
Poor little guy, he was
very nice, just as nice as he can be.
Really. And he was, what, 40-something?
40. And I had to go out with him one night. Oh, gosh. Oh.
And then he told Judy, insulted her, told her that she could move into his
apartment. I said, what? I said, how dare you talk to me like that? He said, well, I didn't mean to insult you. And I said, well,
they are funny.
They are.
Maybe that was a compliment.
Well, yes, it is.
You know, it's the funniest thing because they were, some of their customs and all are most disagreeable to me. And one thing I told Jill, I get no end of pleasure. Say, I'm not a tall person, but I can't stand to be like
this.
They'll come right up to you like this.
And they'll go up to your face and go, beautiful. If they know one word, it's beautiful. And they'll say it right in your
face. And so you
face,
have to walk just... by them, and you get on your tallest shoes, and you walk by them, and you go,
like this.
Jeez, thank
you. I told him one day, I said, it's a matter of how many you can crush.
She's in there, girls, while you're down here, she was giving us our basic training. She said, you crush as many Colombian men as you can.
Oh, they're so ego-centered, really.
They really are.
They are the most ego-centered men I've ever seen. The women are delightful, but the men are just, they think they're God's gift to the world. And they were even oogling my mother. They were. She came into the airport.
I was to her heart, too.
And they were like this, you know. I said, that's my mother. Infuriated me.
Oh, something.
Well, I don't think your mother mentioned that when she was out here.
She was in the airport, and you noticed it because you get this feeling some eyes are watching you.
And you look all in.
And they don't. They're not even. They're not even. What do you call it?
Secretive sort of.
Yeah.
They'll just sit there.
They'll sit
there
and they'll write in your
hand. They'll just look at you like it. You know, you feel like climbing under a table or getting under the seat of the bus, and you'll be sitting there. And you don't ever talk on the bus because if you talk,
no, the bus isn't that bad. The bus is all right because there's four people.
I thought it was horrible.
What's that?
They look at you all the time. And we got on this bus and we couldn't get off. There must have been three, on a regular size school bus, there must have been 200 people packed in there.
About a 1930 model.
And the thing was crashing on.
Oh,
and you stand like this, and these men go, but you're pleasing, you don't know what to do except say a few cuss words at him in Spanish. But you have to hang on to these things, and you're like this, and the buses just go back and forth. And Becky said, all right, Nancy was on the bus, and she said, I don't think the bell works. to get off the bus. And so here this bus flying along the auto piece to 90 to nothing, swaying and people
it's
are crunching and, oh, it was horrible.
They pack them fade just like this. You can't move.
It is. It's miserable. Well, you don't. It's very well explained that.
You have to
work one foot at a time, work your way back like an ostrich almost.
One
back
foot,
to the back
you can get
door.
A foot out, and you find a place where your foot can stand,
and then you try to maneuver
the other one through and not put it down because you have to take the other one out to look for a spot.
Right, the other spot. It's something. But what we
so
did
funny.
Was we would take turns. One of us would get back there by the bell, and we were always standing. We never got a seat. And Becky would hold on with one hand and look down for the stop to come by, see, because we were so tall. And you have to look through people. And Becky's standing there watching, and Nancy's got her thumb on the bell. She says, here it comes, press the button. So Nancy starts pressing the button, and the bus doesn't stop. And the bus is going along, and it was so crowded, we said, Señor, Señor, La Puerta, you know, the door. And he wouldn't stop, and he kept going. And finally, Becky took her fist and started pounding on the roof.
Well, they all did back there. They were trying to help us get off.
Yeah, and the rest of the people started pounding on the roof and finally stopped.
Screeched to a halt for a minute.
He just didn't want to bother
with
you.
He didn't want to stop.
Well, no, he didn't hear.
I don't know what it was. He
was all that mob. He must have had 200
people
on the
bus. Just packed.
Just packed.
Becky, it's sure going to be calm around
it
here.
It is.
In the United States for you, child.
I told Judy. Judy said,
so bored.
What was it that morning?
Better work up a little riot.
Yeah, you better. That morning, 7 o'clock that morning that we left, I heard this 16 floors up in this apartment, rumbling down. And finally, I looked up. Well, I didn't see anything, so I went in. I asked the maid, what in the world was all that rumbling? She said, the tanks just went by.
The tanks were coming in.
They were coming
in
for the revolution. They were really pulling the and these characters in
Jeep.
Even
just as you left. The
yeah,
list.
Yeah. That was a bad day because that was the inaugural
every day.
4
and
o'clock.
And that's when Roloff said it was supposed to come in and take over. So,
well, he'll wait. If he's smart, he'll wait until things calm down.
And then
he'll blow.
Blow in. But we were standing on the corner one day waiting for a bus, and I heard this.
Oh, that was
and
cute.
I said, Becky, look. And we turned around, and this Jeep came around a corner on two wheels, literally two wheels like this. And the doors flew open, and these two people were hanging onto the door, parallel to the ground. And the Jeep straightened up, and they slammed back in and went off. And that Jeep was so close to turning over that if it had turned over, everybody in the thing would have been killed. But it didn't, and we just roared. And then one night we were watching out of we were coming to the Bavaria apartments, and we heard this explosion. And I turned around, and there was this Jeep with smoke just pouring out of it. So we ran in and went up the 16 flights on the elevator and got to the window and looked out. And what had happened was either a Jeep had made these two buses mad and they squashed him in between them, or he hadn't seen the median coming. The median so starts in and then get wide, and he went down the median until he couldn't go any further and his wheels went.
I saw a taxi do that one night. It's the funniest thing I've ever seen. The taxi wasn't paying attention and went down the median, the strip. And the strip gets wider, you know. And he just tore on down the median like he was on the highway. Until all of a sudden his wheels just pushed out like this.
And
he was sitting there
on his belly,
car,
on the middle of
the belly with the wheels, all four wheels, pushed out like a dead fish. It was the funniest thing. Oh, we nearly wrecked the car laughing at that. And this man, I'll tell you this, and we gotta go. But it's the funniest thing. I was mad anyway because we had to leave the dog someplace, and I was getting ready to go in this traffic, and Gerald was in this mission car ahead of us. I was trying to keep up with him, and he drives. I mean, he's going to be put in jail and executed for his driving pretty soon here.
Who?
Gerald.
Oh, does he?
Oh, his driving is just atrocious. He busts in front of people and scoots around, and he'll butt in front of people and stop the car and get out. And all these crazy things.
Of course, all the Colombians do that too. But
they do this, and he's used to just scrambling around in the mess with them. But I have to have order to my driving. But this night I got furious because this, I guess it's about a 1935-something
taxi.
I was doing 45 miles an hour, and this thing pulled right out in front of me. And if I didn't have a decent car, I couldn't have stopped. Pulled right out in front of me. So I said, well, I'm going to get this guy for this. I was furious anyway. So I drove right up on the back end and was sitting on the horn. And the guy got scared and he swerved out and all of his doors flew open on this side. And then he bumped into the curb on this side and was sitting up there, bumped in the curb with his doors open.
And stopped completely and put his hands over his head. Waiting for the crash. Never seen anything.
We
laughed. It's all so emotional.
They are, and they're really emotional because the day we had the dog, we were trying to take the dog and the two birds to the vet, and I didn't have a car, so I was trying to flag down taxis, and taxis didn't want to take that dog. They're afraid of dogs.
Especially a black one.
Yeah, and so I had to tip them to get them to take us places and so forth. So several would pass by and they'd start to stop and see the dog and they'd look and they'd drive, go on, zoot on. One man pulled up and he stopped and he looked and he said, and the worst expression on his face is
to show you, though, how the women are so low down there that they think nothing of a woman was driving down the street in her car and a taxi cut her off, so she rolled down her window and blew her horn and cussed the taxi driver out in Spanish, just called him some filthy names. Well, the taxi driver pulled in front of her and cut her off and got out of his car with a lead pipe and beat her half to death and broke both of her arms, and they fined the woman for insulting the taxi driver. Just right in the middle of
no,
the
they
street.
Did. This happened.
They just beat her. He beat her with a pipe and broke both of her arms, and they fined her for insulting the taxi.
They're funny because they don't.
Why
they,
you don't want to live?
They don't. They really need a women's liberation movement down there.
I think I'll go start one.
But you, I mean, because many of the Colombian men will say, "You're too independent." I said, "Ha ha ha!" Like this too, when they get
they
serious.
They can't stand independent.
They can't. They
think
you ought to sit home and go to the beauty parlor all the time, because that's what most of the women do. They sit home and go to the beauty parlor, and then they all done. And they go, the common thing in the beauty parlor is there is you go in there, and they want to fix your fingernails, and I can't stand that because I figure if I can't fix my own nails, I'm not worth my weight. So I just don't even worry about it. So, go and get my hair cut occasionally, but they'll be doing their feet, and they do their feet. They massage their feet and do their toenails and file the bottoms of their feet. I've never seen that like it. And one woman was in there getting her arms dyed. The other day she was, she had this stuff on her arms. I said, "What is happening?" Well, she's getting her arms lightened so that they look more blonde-like. I said, "Oh, I think she's the one who wanted their arms lightened." Oh, gosh.
So they spend their time in the beauty parlor.
Well, the women do.
The
wealthy. The poor women, well, the poor people, and the majority of the people are the poor. They work, and that's all they do, because they barely make a meager existence.
I didn't know you were living right in the middle of the city.
Yeah.
I thought you were living out in the countryside.
No, we're right in the middle of, well, we're on the northern part of Bogota, which was, it's about a 10-minute drive, no, 20-minute drive in town.
Did you know they were living right in the city?
Yeah,
you don't
live out on the outskirts because of the banditos.
You wouldn't
want to
live out
unless you have
dangerous.
A big house and a lot of dogs and stuff.
One friend of ours had, they had 7 German shepherds guarding their place. I mean, and ferocious.
In town?
No, out. At a finca. And really, it's dangerous because if you've got any money, you're robbed a lot of times. And one man, I'll never forget, I've never been so thankful for those dogs. Gerald goes away occasionally down to this village to do his work. And I'm terrified those nights that he's away because, really, even though the maid's in the house and living, still people watch the house because I'd get these phone calls where people would call up and they wouldn't say anything and they'd hang up. And they'd do this, I guess, and they'd do this mainly when he was gone. Well, one night, Tony was up there and he sleeps with his head. The windows were low. And I sleep on the second story. And the windows were low, and they're looking around the street, and I woke up one night, and he's in, just lunging like it's something and warning something. And I looked out, and it's 3 a.m., and there's this man standing right outside the window, just watching the window up there. At 3 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got up, and I turned on the lights, and made sure that he knew that I was awake up there and knew what was going on. I called the maid and told her that someone was watching the house. But you have to really be careful. Even though our house was really very secure because you had to come into a garage, there are no windows on the bottom floor, exception with a small window in the maid's room that has bars on it. But the bottom floors in most houses, if they have glass windows, they're barred.
Oh,
heavy bars. And ours just had a garage, and then you had to have an entrance way in through the garage to the house, and then the floors and the windows on the second floor were glass, of course, but without bars. Someone would have to crawl up there, but someone told me that one night someone crawled up to a second floor window, and they had a big German shepherd sleeping in the room, and they pulled the dog out and broke his neck, threw him down the floor below and broke his neck and broke into the house. You just really sort of, the more precautious you are, the better off you are, because I've been extremely precautious and nothing has happened.
Did you sleep well?
Well, yes, not really, because you worry, you know. But with the dogs, 2 dogs in the room, I think anything that happens, I'll hear about it. First. And besides, it's better than being in the house because if someone broke in and stole something, that wouldn't be so bad. But they broke in and the dogs attacked them and they tried to kill them or killed them, that would really upset me. If the dogs were in the room just to protect me so that if the man got into my room, I mean, it would, you know, it'd be better. I'd just assume they'd go on and get what they want and get out.
Is that what you did?
The dog stayed in
the room. Dog stayed in my room when Gerald went away. Well, they stayed in the room anytime. We always kept the door locked, the bedroom door. We'd never leave it open. And then we had bars, you know, these latch bars, about 3 on each door, plus a double lock.
Good Lord.
I mean, it really, everyone
but
said...
I mean, that's the way you just had to live.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I mean, and you would never leave a door open, ever leave a door. You'd never leave a small window open. We'd leave, there were windows about this high and this narrow that we would leave open, as long as nothing was in reaching distance of them. But we never had any problems, but the neighbors down the street got robbed one night. Someone just smashed the window and tried to come in, and the parents heard them and came on down the stairs. But they know, they're smart. These banditos, they know everything.
Oh, yeah.
They know who's
around
American, and
they
know
they know the house, and they survey that house long before. What we had some friends. It was the funniest thing. They had the maid. They got the maid, and they would fairly new in DeBoer. Thought they had gotten this silver and stuff. I never took anything decent down there anyway. But they had this silver and stuff, and they were real rich. And this mover came and said, well, he had a trunk for them. And the maid said, no, the people tell me every time something comes, there's no need for this trunk here. Said, no, they ordered and they had papers and everything filled out, and the man looked like he had signed it. So the maid let him in. They left the trunk in the living room. The maid went on about her business. About 2 hours later, the man came back and said, oh, I'm sorry, this is the wrong house. And they pulled the trunk back out. Then the maid realized a lot of silver was missing. Someone had been in that trunk and gotten out of the trunk and took the silver, put it back in the trunk, and the people came back for them. So they think of all these interesting things.
Mm, it's really
you
smart.
Would think of that. You know, that's pretty clever. But
next?
To sit in
yes.
that trunk like that.
Yes, you wouldn't expect
someone to be like a jack-in-the-box.
Any violence to take place.
But as long as you don't argue with them, from what we hear, there's no problem, except now with, like in Uruguay, they're having a lot of problem with these political prisoners and these kidnappings. And the ambassador to the U.S. Ambassador Vaughn to Colombia resigned. Well, he resigned.